This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The call for global racial equality continues. Here in the U.S., lawmakers want to know President Trump's role in deploying American troops to put down protests. Top military brass are not giving Congress any answers.
I think it's a significant misstep by the Department of Defense.
Also, in former colonial powers, protests are bringing down statues, symbols of Europe's own history of racial oppression.
All the statues are living there the last hours and the scale of history, you know.
And the coronavirus, much more deadly for the elderly, many of whom also happen to be eyewitnesses to 20th century history.
I've never met anyone who had survived so many disasters.
And in some places anyway, finally some great news about the pandemic.
Today there are no active cases in New Zealand.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you here this Monday. Movements for greater equality gain and lose steam. This time, though, feels different, bigger, more widespread, and across the globe calls to end systemic racial discrimination do not appear to be slowing down. In London, protesters are chanting, "I can't breathe." In Rome, speakers demand an end to police brutality. We've seen the same in Australia's capital, Canberra. In Hong Kong, people like Quinlan Anderson explained why the killing of a black man in Minnesota is reverberating in a Chinese territory thousands of miles away.
As much as it is an issue with the U.S., it is a global issue. People around the world will be looking at the U.S. and thinking to themselves that obviously black lives don't seem to matter that much, but we have to remind ourselves that despite all we see going on in the U.S. and in other parts of the world, black lives do indeed matter.
Protests also continue to grow in Japan, South Korea, Lebanon, Kenya, and South Africa, to name just a few places. Hope that the swell of activism will lead to lasting change. Most of the recent global protests have been peaceful, with some exceptions. A London street fight this weekend led to multiple arrests and police injuries. Police in Bristol, England, are also investigating property damage. Dramatic scenes there over the weekend, powered by anger over Bristol's history with the transatlantic slave trade. The World's Orla Barry reports from London.
The statue of slave trader Edward Colston stood in the city centre of Bristol for 115 years. On the plaque that remains are the words, "A memorial of one of the most virtuous and wise sons of Bristol." Below that, someone painted in white spray paint, "Black Lives Matter." This was the moment the Colston statue was pulled off its pedestal on Sunday. A demonstrator posed with one knee on the figure's neck, a reminder of the final moments of George Floyd's life, who was killed in police custody in Minneapolis. For this protester, it wasn't just about a monument in Bristol.
That coming down today hopefully signifies change. Hopefully we've sent a message not just to everyone in the UK or the USA, worldwide. We need worldwide difference. It can't just come here. It can't just come in America. It needs to come worldwide.
As protesters rolled the 18-foot bronze statue through the streets of the city, local police stood by and watched.
You might wonder why we didn't intervene and why we just allowed people to put it in the docks. We made a very tactical decision that to stop people from doing that act may have caused further disorder, and we decided the safest piece to do in terms of our policing tactics was to allow it to take place.
But today, police say they've launched an investigation into what happened, and the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, welcomed that decision.
It's right, actually, the police follow up on that and make sure that justice is undertaken with those individuals that are responsible for such disorderly and lawless behaviour.
For years, the statue has been a source of controversy in Bristol, one of England's most progressive cities. Trader Edward Colston was born in the city and made his fortune through the Royal African Company. Historians say the company sold close to 100,000 people from West Africa to the Americas in the 1600s. Colston later donated much of his wealth to local schools and charities. But David Olushoga from the University of Manchester says people in political power didn't care where the money came from.
There's a cult of Colston that was created for political and religious reasons in the 1890s because the people who ran Bristol then didn't really worry the fact that Colston had been a slave trader. He's not the greatest philanthropist in the city. It's really to do with the attempts by Bristol's political and merchant elite to reinforce their power and their religious bigotry.
A spokesman for the British Prime Minister says Boris Johnson sees the statue's removal as a criminal act. Others say it erases history, but Olushoga dismisses that line of criticism.
This is not an attack on history. This is what happens. Statues are removed, they're replaced, they're put in museums, they're taken off pedestals. Go to Germany, outside of Berlin, there is a museum full of statues, the Siegelallee statues. And they were removed after the Second World War because they reminded everybody of the Prussian militarism that had led to two world wars.
While his statue now lies at the bottom of Bristol Harbour, Colston's presence is still very visible in the city.
It's the way the Colston name dominates our skyline, and particularly in the centre of Bristol.
Ros Martin is an artist and one of the driving forces behind the Countering Colston campaign, which has been fighting to have the statue removed.
You know, there's a Colston Tower, there's a, you know, the hall, there's a Colston Avenue, etc, etc.
She says it's time to remove Colston's name from streets and buildings across Bristol. Today, an empty plinth still stands in the city centre, and questions are now being asked about who or what should replace the statue. Martin says it's time to pay tribute to those whose voices are rarely acknowledged.
I think there should be a monument to African ancestors, acknowledging they're contributing to the wealth of the city. There's lots of things that can be done to put forward our history in a skyline which honours usually those without voices.
The Mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees, who's black, says he doesn't support social disorder, but he called the Colston statue an affront to humanity. One day, he said, it should be fished out of the harbour and put into a museum. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
This debate is not just happening in the US and Britain. Belgium is full of statues of King Leopold II, who led the brutal colonization of Congo. He was responsible for millions of deaths in Africa. Over the weekend, these statues became a flashpoint for protesters. One statue in the city of Ghent was splashed with red paint and tagged with the phrase, "I can't breathe." A petition to remove likenesses of Leopold in Brussels has gained more than 60,000 signatures. These are the kinds of things that Belgian Rwandan artist Laura Singiyumva has grappled with in her work. In her 2018 piece, People, for example, a giant ice statue of King Leopold II slowly melted over the course of a day. Singiyumva joins us from Brussels. Thank you for being with us, Laura. How does it feel to you to see a renewed movement take these statues down? What does this moment feel like to you?
This moment in particular, it's amazing. It's very intense. I didn't see it coming that fast. When I had this vision of melting Leopold II, I thought it would take a few more years. Of course, it was like a spark. I wanted to ignite a spark, but even in my craziest dream, I didn't think that in 2 years this would happen. And I really think that all the statues are living there the last hours, and that's incredible to experience this in my lifetime.
So yeah. For people here in the U.S., Laura, who may not be familiar with the history, we have to go back to the mid-19th century. What does King Leopold II's image actually represent?
King Leopold is the Belgian king who started to colonize Congo, Rwanda, and Burundi. It's a figure, a character that is very much celebrated here in Belgium. We don't learn at school about the genocide that happened. We just really live in a propaganda, in the colonial propaganda still. So it's a bit tricky to wake everyone up because, of course, it's so internalized. And what's happening globally really helps us getting this introspection, I think.
And Belgium's colonial past is embedded in many different places. You find it in museum collections, in school curricula. What work have institutions done to reckon with that history?
Schools and museums, we are not that far yet. There are still a lot of institutionalized racism. So even as an artist working with the museum, it's a bit tricky because we need to make them aware and to keep the dialogue open. And with schools, we're not there yet. We're just, that's one of our demands right now with the whole decolonial movements. One of the most important demands is education, and that is still not happening in Belgium.
You've also spoken out in the past, Laura, against racist elements in public rituals in Belgium, like the Ducasse Duff festival, which includes a character in blackface, or the Christmas character of Zwarte Piet. Do you think this moment's going to get people to reconsider the way they think about these traditions?
I think the whole thing is so connected. It's all the same propaganda. And I really think Zwarte Piet is not going to last long either. From what I saw, because even in the protest in Brussels, people were screaming, kick out Zwarte Piet.
For you personally, Laura, where do you want to take your art in this moment? What is this moment telling you to say?
Oh my God, I have so many things to say. I have even more work than before, I think, because before it was all about making people aware, but now it's really about educating and shaping really the present, shaping the new monuments, because we started the conversation already about what's going to replace those monuments and how we're going to teach to the kids. So yeah, it's just starting.
If you had to design a new monument, what would it look like?
I designed it already. When I saw this vision of melting Leopold II, I was very, very genuine. I really want the real statue to be melted into a new monument in memory of the victims. And why I want to melt it and transform into something new is just we have this common heritage, this common history that we cannot erase, but we can make it take another shape and tell another story.
Laura Singijumva is a Belgian Rwandan artist and architect. She's been speaking with us from Brussels. Thank you very much, Laura. Good to speak with you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you.
The other big global story is, of course, the pandemic. And there's some really good news to share today. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier.
101 days after the first coronavirus case in New Zealand, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has an announcement.
We united in unprecedented ways to crush the virus. Today, there are no active cases in New Zealand.
New Zealand is coronavirus-free. Nobody there is currently being treated for the disease, and nobody has tested positive for 17 days. Prime Minister Ardern's immediate reaction to the news was not your typical politician's response.
I did a little dance.
That celebration is appropriate, since no cases means no restrictions.
And so today, I can announce that Cabinet has agreed we will now move to level one.
Level one means public transport, retail stores, schools, sports, weddings, hospitality, and basically everything else can return to business as usual. Social distancing encouraged, but not required. One Kiwi wrote on Twitter, "So happy we can go about our day, no worries in catching COVID-19 in New Zealand. It's nice to see smiles again on people's faces, not hidden by masks." Thanks, Jacinda Ardern. Praise has come in from around the world for how the prime minister handled the pandemic. The country of 5 million people reported 1,100 cases and 22 deaths from the disease. If you're thinking, get me on a plane to New Zealand ASAP, put your passport away. International travelers are not yet welcome.
This freedom from restrictions relies so heavily on the ongoing role that our border controls will play in keeping the virus out.
Keeping the virus out to stave off a second wave. Ardern said New Zealanders need to stay united.
So while the job is not done, there is no denying this is a milestone. So can I finish with a very simple thank you, New Zealand.
For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The good news from New Zealand can feel far removed, especially for people who are grieving the deaths of loved ones from COVID-19. Just ahead, we remember the extraordinary life of Teresa Romanowska, who died of COVID-19 last week. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. It is said in parts of West Africa that when an old person dies, it's as if a library burns to the ground. The coronavirus has now claimed more than 400,000 lives worldwide. Many of the victims have been older, robbing us of institutional memories to the past. People like Teresa Romanowska, who died last week in Washington, D.C. at the age of 89. Born in Poland, she survived the German invasion in World War II, detention in a Nazi camp, and Soviet oppression. Her daughter, Indira Lakshmanan, joins me now from Washington. Indira, first of all, our condolences to you. Tell us about your mother. If there's one thing you'd want us to know about her that isn't obvious in her story that we'll get to in a moment, what is it?
Well, she was someone with just an incredible and indomitable will to live and will to survive. And of anyone I've ever known in my life, and as a journalist, I've been incredibly fortunate to have interviewed thousands of people over the last 30 years. I've never met anyone who had survived so many disasters and so many things that it feels like would bring down any one human. And for her to ultimately have been felled by coronavirus, well, it is just, it brings it home really painfully. Mm.
Your mother's resilience and that will to live began in September of 1939. She was 8, and that's when Nazi Germany invaded Poland and World War II began. What do you know about that time?
So as I said in the piece that I wrote for National Geographic just a month ago as part of our Last Voices of World War II special package, which is the theme of our June issue, was, you know, VE Day and the end of World War II and trying to memorialize these last voices. My mom was only 8 years old when she was essentially robbed of her childhood. Not only was there the terrifying sound of the German bombing over Warsaw on September 1st, 1939, but just 15 days later, there were, you know, German soldiers in her literal front yard and Polish soldiers who had dug foxholes. And by the end of that day, when she and her family were cowering in the basement, hearing Polish soldiers die in their garden, German soldiers came to the door, ordered them out at gunpoint, forced her mother and her brother to bury the bodies of, you know, a number of dead soldiers outside, took away her father, shot a Jewish neighbor right in front of them, took away his hysterical family. My grandfather was one of all the fathers, all the elder males in the neighborhood who were taken away. Later, my mother, my grandmother, my uncle were basically told that day, you know, take away your belongings, whatever you can fit with you, and they seized their home. There were many other levels of the story, but, you know, there was just one painful incident after another for her, as there were for so many children who survived World War II.
There's a detail in her story about a treasured toy fox that may seem banal, but for a child, it's kind of so gut-wrenching.
Yeah, that's right, Marco. My mother, you know, all my life had recounted to me this story. She had this beloved stuffed fox that she slept with, and she was clutching it, you know, when she first heard the German barrage and when the soldiers came and when they forced her and her mother and brother out of their house. They had stuffed whatever belongings they could fit into an old baby carriage. She was holding on to that fox, and the German soldier saw it and grabbed the stuffed fox out of my mother's hands. The way I described it is that it was like, you know, it was essentially like a perverse trophy to the subjugation of other humans.
Teresa was not Jewish. As a child, how did she end up, along with the family, heading to a Nazi concentration camp, and how did she escape?
Yeah. So my mother was Polish Catholic from an educated, noble family. You know, the Nazis persecuted everybody in Poland, and of course, they started with the Jews. The Polish intelligentsia and those associated with the resistance were also persecuted. So in 1944, she and her mother were taken off to basically a German transit camp. The story of how they escaped is really a quite dramatic one. They were, you know, put onto a train. They thought they were on their way to Auschwitz. At one point, when the train slowed down and opened to air out the stench of excrement from the people who were forced to relieve themselves on these cattle cars, My grandmother jumped off the train and screamed, "Teresa, jump." My mother, you know, jumped after her in this moment. She was 13 years old at the time. They ran into some bushes. Shots were fired behind them. They were not hit.
That will to live you spoke about, Indira. I mean, your mother was a fighter. She survived World War II and Polish communism and also beat cancer.
She beat breast cancer twice. Wow. And, you know, also survived a very acrimonious divorce. The difficulties of trying as a woman to return to the workforce in the 1970s after having left to be a homemaker. It was just astonishing to me, even as a young girl, to see the grit and determination in everything she did. And much more recently, just a year ago, my mother suffered a terrible stroke. And it was very debilitating. And one of the most painful things about it was that the stroke caused her to have hallucinations and delusions. And essentially, she regressed to the Nazi period. And wow. In the hospital, in the intensive care unit, a year ago, she was hallucinating that the nurses and doctors were Nazi prison guards trying to do experiments on her. Because one of the things she had told me was that in this transit camp where they were held outside of Warsaw, even though there was disease, there was cholera, there was typhus, there was lice, there were all sorts of problems, everybody was more terrified of these so-called doctors and medical staff than they were of the actual disease. They were so petrified of what might be done to them. So in that period a year ago, my mom, she literally was able to fight off nurses who were trying to give her shots for her health because she thought they were Nazi guards. So that was incredibly painful, seeing the PTSD come back in that way. And yet, once she was better from those delusions, she astonished everyone by being able to get some movement back to her left arm and her left leg. They never thought she'd be able to do it, but she had such a force of will that although she was not able to walk again, she was able to get a lot more movement back than anyone thought was possible.
Indira Lakshmanan, Senior Executive Editor for National Geographic. Thank you very much for sharing the story of your mother, Teresa Romanowska. And again, I'm very sorry for your loss, Indira.
Thank you so much, Marco. I really appreciate your inviting me to talk about her and share her life with your listeners.
Teresa Romanowska's story is a reminder of just how devastating the coronavirus pandemic has been all around the globe and in every part of our lives. The world is determined to bring you voices with content and firsthand perspectives. It's more important now than ever. You can find more of our reporting on COVID-19 at theworld.org/coronavirus. Coronavirus lockdowns are lifting. Many say a return to normalcy can't happen soon enough, that the costs of closure are huge. Epidemiologists don't dispute that.
But the cost directly from COVID is so potentially large that it just offsets everything.
Also, nations in Africa try to protect their borders from the pandemic. That's all coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. One step forward, two steps back. Earlier this hour, we told you about the good news in New Zealand. They've declared themselves free of the coronavirus. Iceland also seems to have contained the outbreak. Unfortunately, these bright spots are not many. Across the globe, COVID-19 cases are rising and faster than ever. Over the past week, there have been more than 100,000 new cases each day on average. If you look back at April, new cases never topped that mark during the entire month, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Here to ground us in where we're at right now is the world's Alana Gordon. Alana, give us the bird's eye view of this pandemic. Where are we seeing the biggest growth in cases?
So, Marco, the number of cases globally, it appears to be going up fast. I talked to Jennifer Nuzzo. She's an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University, the group that's been tracking a lot of this around the globe. She said last week was a red flag. The number of new cases before then had averaged about 500,000 a week, and that jumped to 600,000.
So yes, there is an increase in cases. And the countries now that are reporting cases, you know, outside of the U.S. that are particularly concerning because of the speed with which their cases are occurring are very large and, you know, very populous countries. And so we deeply do worry about transmission.
So the increases appear to be shifting from the U.S. and Europe to these other large places, although there are lots of places in the U.S. that are spiking right now. Where exactly is it moving to?
So we're seeing an acceleration in parts of the Middle East. India, Russia, parts of Africa have seen increases. Earlier today, Mike Ryan, he's head of emergency operations for the World Health Organization, he expressed a lot of concern about Latin America. In the last week, Guatemala has experienced a 50% increase in fatalities. And the patterns vary from Mexico to Chile, but it's a major concern for him.
Right now, the epidemic in Central and South America is the most complex of all of the situations we face globally, and one in which the world needs to work and come to the support and aid of countries in the region in order to assist them in dealing with this high-impact pandemic.
So should we be expecting more deaths and more cases now?
Well, we're learning that if communities do nothing, that's a really bad idea, and one can expect to see a lot of deaths and cases. Two studies actually came out this week in Nature examining the impact of these really blunt tools of the shutdowns and the stay-at-home orders, the cancellations of gatherings, and it found that these measures potentially saved tens of thousands of lives. Dr. Samir Bhatt is a co-author on one of those studies focused on Europe and places like Italy. I talked to him earlier. He's an epidemiologist at the Imperial College of London.
No one questions the fact that putting in lockdown will cost some lives in other ways, right? People missing health appointments and things like that. But the cost directly from COVID is so potentially large that it just offsets everything. That's what our estimate potentially can show. And so if you're cost balancing things based on lives, the lockdown saved a lot of lives.
Yeah, you said tens of thousands of lives, maybe more, right, Alana?
Yeah, I mean, I should add that there is a caveat to this kind of powerful analysis, which is that it's unclear whether these deaths and cases from coronavirus were actually prevented or just delayed, because that answer to that question really depends on what happens next, whether it's in new places that are experiencing surges for the first time or those that have already gotten out of their first wave. Because the thing to keep in mind, Marco, is that most of us around the globe are susceptible to this disease, even in the places that have been hardest hit. We're still at the beginning of all this.
Right. 6 months in, we are still at the beginning and it's still spreading. So, Ilana, what do we do next to break the chain of transmission?
So public health experts say that breaking the chain of transmission relies on things like contact tracing, isolating new infections, having good surveillance, and resources for health workers. It's also important to keep in mind that despite the challenges ahead, many places have a lot of experience with infectious disease containment and disaster response, places that are now struggling with what they're seeing as a surge in cases. So again, here's Mike Ryan from the World Health Organization speaking earlier today.
Countries in Central and South America have a hugely proud history of dealing with infectious diseases. It was this continent that, or subcontinent, that first eradicated polio, all three strains. It was this continent that actually eliminated measles and offered an opportunity for global measles elimination.
And Marco, he says that for this kind of containment to happen with coronavirus, governments really need to take the lead and coordinate. It's not any one intervention alone, Marco, that will work. It has to be a combination. But that's also what makes what happened in Brazil so concerning this past weekend. On Friday, the president pulled the overall reporting data on deaths and case counts down. He removed it, and that means that a lot of that community is now in the dark.
Yeah, that was stunning news. We'll stay on top of that. The World's Ilana Gordon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Parts of East Africa are starting to reopen and loosen up emergency lockdown measures. In Kenya, some restaurants are back in business. In Tanzania, flights are resuming. And in Uganda, the national parks are opening back up. But when it comes to preventing new COVID-19 infections, protocol for the borders between these adjacent countries is still a work in progress. Here's the world's Halima Gikandi with more.
In Uganda, something like normal daily life is returning to the streets. Last week, the government lifted a ban on public vehicles like buses, as long as they operate at half capacity. But for truck drivers traveling in and out of Uganda, not much has changed. Elijah Nyaga is the chairman of the Long Distance Truckers and Conductors Association in Kenya.
Many of my members have been sacked. It has affected everyone.
Drivers losing their jobs is one thing. Commercial truck traffic in the region is also way down because of the strict coronavirus prevention measures put in place at border checkpoints across East Africa. Here's Kenyan Governor Sospeter Ojimong speaking to local media last week. He issued an ultimatum for drivers in Uganda who are trying to cross into Kenya.
We are not going to allow trucks or truck drivers entry into Busia County if they do not have a negative certificate for COVID.
In other words, prove they can show they're not infected with COVID-19 first, then they can cross the border. For truck drivers like Nyaga, the problem is not just prevention measures aimed at limiting the spread of COVID-19. In fact, Nyaga says he wants his drivers to be safe. He's been distributing sanitizers and face masks to thousands of drivers. Still, he says the problem is with the way the prevention measures are being carried out. At the Malaba border point where Kenyan and Uganda meet, some drivers have had to wait a week for COVID-19 tests. That's created a 50-mile-long backup of trucks.
They have to show the certificate, but the certificate does not be recognized by the Ugandan authorities.
Nyaga says it's a bureaucratic issue. Drivers who have a negative coronavirus certificate from Kenya are still having to wait for a new test issued by the Ugandan government. Joseph Magula is an epidemiologist in Uganda. He's currently stationed in Alegu at the border between Uganda and South Sudan, where truck drivers are the only people allowed to cross, because Uganda still bans public transportation in and out of the country. Magula says there's a reason officials are being extra cautious. While East African countries have a lot of experience dealing with infectious diseases at border points, the coronavirus has brought a new set of challenges.
With something like Ebola, you know what to look out for. You know the signs and the symptoms to check out for. With COVID, a lot of cases are asymptomatic, so many times the people can't tell.
Truck drivers are also seen as a vulnerable population for disease transmission. In Nyaga's organization, 127 drivers have already tested positive for the virus, but they are essential for bringing in foods and goods into landlocked countries like Uganda. Magula thinks the problem lies with testing. At the Uganda-South Sudan border, it's taking between 24 to 48 hours to test truck drivers. It's much slower at the border with Kenya. Health officers are using expensive testing machines that take a long time to issue results. Sometimes the machines break down.
We need to have a more faster and rapid way of delivering test results to people who have been sampled.
Health officials are opening up mobile testing labs to help relieve the backlog in testing, and a quicker rapid test could come soon. Scientists at Makerere University in Uganda are currently working on a 1 to 2 minute test. Until then, truck drivers in East Africa are in for the long haul. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Back to our other top story, global protesters demanding racial equality. Here in the U.S., the same protests have led to tensions between the Pentagon and the White House, as well as tensions between the Pentagon and Congress. Lawmakers are trying to learn more about President Trump's desire to deploy active duty military troops to put down recent demonstrations. Members of the House Armed Services Committee want to hear from Pentagon Chief Mark Esper and head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley. Both have refused to appear before the panel. James Stavridis says that's a mistake. Stavridis is a retired Navy admiral and former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO.
I think it's a significant misstep by the Department of Defense. Throughout my time as a senior military officer, I testified in front of Congress on many occasions, didn't always want to go and do that. It can be uncomfortable, but it's a fundamental right of the American people to hear from senior military leadership. That's the role of the House Armed Services Committee. I'm quite surprised they're refusing to go and testify.
What does that tell us about the moment we're living in?
Last Monday, as we all know, we saw demonstrations, largely peaceful, that were stopped in order to provide a photo op for President Trump. The military got pulled into participating in that. That's obviously what the Congress wants to hear about. I'd like to know more about the facts of that case. It bespeaks an attempt on the part of the administration to politicize the military that is unwarranted and I think, frankly, dangerous.
Well, to that point, we learned this weekend that President Trump demanded that 10,000 active duty troops be ordered into American streets at the height of the recent protests. That's according to a senior defense official. What would that have looked like across the nation?
Well, it would have been a terrible moment for the country. And I'll tell you, Marco, as both NATO commander and previously as commander U.S. Southern Command in charge of all military activity south of the United States, I would often talk to government officials and senior military officials in other countries about how inappropriate it is to use armed military against protesters. I never thought I'd be in a position of criticizing that here in our own country.
As you say, Admiral, in the end, Secretary Esper rebuffed President Trump's threat to deploy soldiers. General Milley declared that U.S. armed forces would not allow themselves to be used against nonviolent protesters. In making those statements, were Esper and Milley publicly daring the president to fire them?
I wouldn't use the word dare, but I think that they are doing their job. Ultimately, of course, they may have to take dramatic action, but I think they wanted to make this public so that if they do end up resigning, there's a track record going back to the beginning of the controversy.
So if Esper and Milley went that far with these comments, why not appear before the Armed Services Committee?
Good question. You'd have to address that to the two of them. I am hopeful, and occasionally we see this, that there's a kind of negotiation between a congressional committee and some branch of the executive department about what will be discussed, what's classified, what is in the realm of advice given directly to the president. So perhaps there is a conversation like that unfolding.
Senator Tom Cotton wrote in the New York Times in support of putting federal troops in the streets to stop protests, which was an opinion so out there that the editor of the Times who let that op-ed through resigned. Why, Admiral, if you see the existentially troublesome side of that proposition, why are there American lawmakers supporting it?
It's hard for me to gauge that. And let's just for a moment do the numbers here. We've got over 1 million sworn law enforcement officers in the United States. We have 500,000 members of the National Guard who are trained, who are citizen soldiers, who know how to be backing up police officers. That's almost 1.5 million people. I see nothing going on in terms of violence or looting or disturbances that would be beyond the reach of that 1.5 million force. So I don't understand this desire to pull the active duty military into this.
What are you watching most closely, like a decision or a shift in position that will tell us about the military's relationship with the White House right now?
I will look for whether or not the Secretary of Defense remains in his post. There have been conflicting signals in terms of confidence in him. But from what I can see, he is speaking truth to power to the president in terms of recommending no active duty troop use. So watch for how long Secretary Esper remains in the job.
James Stavridis is a retired Navy admiral and former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Thank you very much for being with us, Admiral.
Thanks, Marco.
This moment we're living through feels huge. It is important, a reckoning with how African Americans and more widely people of color have been subjugated in so many different ways for so long. African immigrants are among those now speaking out in the U.S. Sefi Atta is a Nigerian novelist and playwright. Her home for the past 20 years has been Mississippi. Sefi Atta spoke with me from her home in Meridian, population 37,000. She told me how this moment looks and feels to her, a native Nigerian, and someone who has lived here for 20 years.
As much as I'm happy to give my perspective as a Nigerian in America, I'm a recent American. I came here in 1994, and I became an American citizen in 2009. So my experience has been as a Black immigrant in the United States, which is separate from the African-American experience. Mm. My ancestors weren't forced to come here, and I have not lived with the generational trauma that can come with that.
So just starting there, what difference does that make in terms of how you are treated as an outsider?
Until I open my mouth, people don't know where I'm coming from. But it's not so much about my experience here as what I've observed. It doesn't have to happen to me for me to be affected. For the most part, my experience here has been prosaic. I write in a room. I don't get out that much, but when I do, I speak to people. about race and racism. And I'm very vocal about it. I don't speak to white people here about either of those issues because I don't see the point. But I have spoken to African Americans here. Mm. Not everyone is open to having such discussions with me, perhaps because they see me as a foreigner. So my thing is to be respectful at all times. And if I sense that people are not willing to get into that discussion with me, then I leave it at that.
I was going to ask you, what has changed in race relations and attitudes in, well, the 2 decades that you've lived in Mississippi?
Not much. We had our first black mayor elected in 2013, but culturally it hasn't changed that much. For instance, with the protests here have been limited. There was a small gathering downtown, and it was led by pastors, black and white. I can't speak for all of Mississippi, but this is how Meridian deals with racial conflicts. They bring religion into the equation to quieten everyone.
The U.S. is often seen by outsiders as the South is where race is a problem, as opposed to northern states, supposedly more progressive. When you hear that stereotype, Sefi, what's your reaction to someone who has lived, who lives in Mississippi?
Yeah. And, you know, before this, I lived in New Jersey for 3 years and I worked in New York and New Jersey. I also had a stint in L.A. where I went to school. So I've been in different regions and I've seen how racism plays out. We cannot ignore the history of the South and the brutality of it. Meridian is the birthplace of James Earl Cheney, the civil rights activist who was murdered by the Ku Klux Klan in 1964, the year I was born, along with Andrew Goodman and Michael Schirner.
Right.
They were white activists from New
York.
Voter
registration drives.
So you have a sense sometimes here of not being too far from the past. And I don't get that feeling in LA or in New York. However, where was Rodney King beaten? That was in LA. Where was Amadou Diallo killed? That was in New York. Where was George Floyd murdered? That was in Minneapolis. So people say that racism is less pronounced elsewhere, but I think it depends on who you are, how you observe what goes on around you. And I can't say it's much different in other parts of the country.
So let me ask you about you as an individual, Sefi. How is this moment that we're living through changing you? Do you feel personally invested in what's happening?
You know, for me, I think I'm a storyteller, first and foremost. And I think storytelling is part of dialogue. And I've always written about race and racism. I've always included it in my stories. I do feel that sometimes the publishing industry would like to control the way in which Black immigrants write about race and racism in America. I had one experience in my previous book, A Bit of Difference, in which I touch on issues of liberal racism in my first chapter. And a friend of mine introduced me to her New York agent who read the book and before it was published and thought that the first chapter should be removed. And I said, thank you. And we parted ways. My friend was really angry with me. Mm-hmm. He said, this is the difference between having a career and not having one. But, you know, I became a writer because I want to express myself. And if I can't do that, if anyone interferes with my expression, it's difficult for me. I cannot work with them.
Sefi, does this moment help you imagine a transformed Meridian, Mississippi? And what do you hope that would look like?
No, it doesn't. I've been here long enough to know that things, if they change at all, will change very slowly. Because of the advocacy, I'm here and I'm able to live and work in a place like Mississippi and walk around quite freely. So it's my duty to continue to support the advancement of Black people through my writing. I don't rely on America to do anything in that regard, because I've seen people who are greater than me, braver than me, fight for so many years, and still we come back to the same places.
Sefi Atta is a Nigerian novelist and playwright who lives in Meridian, Mississippi. Her latest novel is The Bead Collector. Thank you very much, Sefi, for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Here's another Nigeria-U.S. connection.
It's 2,000 Black, and of course, we're hoping that by the year 2000... We know that by the year 2000, that's even better. Everybody will be knowledgeable. You understand, everybody Black, 2000 Black, 2000.
American vibraphonist and singer Roy Ayers collaborated with Nigerian music pioneer Fela Kuti in 1980. Like Sefi Atta, the late Fela Kuti also wrote passionately about the struggle. In fact, Fela is Sefi's uncle.
Fela is a huge influence on my work and my writing. And, you know, when I moved here in 1997, he died in August. I moved here in July, he died in August. And we were listening to his music and I'd play it and I'd be listening to it and writing. And it was just, it guided me as a writer.
We leave you with this performance by Fela Kuti and Roy Ayers, 2000, Black's Gotta Be Free. I'm Marco Werman in the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. Thank you for listening. And stay safe, be strong, and be healthy. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.